Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 137 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. Our guest this week is the founder of a small record label releasing some of the best audiophile albums around, A.B. Fahn of Impex Records. Fahn worked in a dental office and for a bank before she joined her father at Cisco Music and helped launch an audiophile label there. Cisco was an early proponent of 180 gram records and made a name for itself through such releases as Steely Dan's Asia, Linda Ronstadt's Heart Like a Wheel, and Jennifer Warren's famous Blue Raincoat. After Cisco closed in 2008, Fahn, with much of her team in tow, launched Impex Records in early 2009. Impex has thrived in a crowded audiophile world that includes such heavy hitters as Mobile Fidelity, Analog Productions, Blue Note, and Kraft Recordings. Impex has received acclaim for several releases from Patricia Barber, including a sold-out one-step of Cafe Blue, Earth, Wind, and Fire's That's the Way of the World, more Jennifer Warren's albums, and El Dimeola, John McLaughlin, and Paco de Lucia's Friday Night in San Francisco, and its follow-up, Saturday Night in San Francisco. In this illuminating conversation, Fahn tells of the challenges and triumphs of running Impex and how the landscape has changed over the years. How does Impex come up with its titles? Is there a big wish list? Does the label have to bid against its competitors? How do licensing agreements work? Does Impex have to guarantee selling a certain number of copies? Is it tricky to get to do a repress? How did Impex come to do a 2LP 45 RPM one-step of the Brazilian jazz classic Gets Gilberto when Analog Productions already had out a 45 RPM version? How does Impex decide whether to do an album at 33 or 45 RPM or as a one-step? Does the label have access to master tapes as often as it used to? Is working from a one-to-one analog transfer better than working from a high-resolution digital copy? What distinguishes an Impex release from those by other high-end companies? How important a marketing hook are limited editions and numbered copies? Which act has been Fahn's white whale for Impex? Which projects has she been most excited to land? Fahn pulls back the curtain on the audiophile release world, and I know you'll appreciate this glimpse inside. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with A.B. Fahn. Tell me how you got to the point doing what you're doing now.
Okay. Well, it was quite a journey. And yes, I started working at a bank, Wells Fargo Bank. That's kind of where I started my career. I was there for almost 5 years. I got married quite young, and my husband is a dentist. And so we purchased a small little dental office in North Hollywood, actually Studio City, North Hollywood area. And I left the bank to join him and start our practice. So I worked the front, he worked the back, and I quickly learned and understood billing and booking patients. And it was a fun 2 year. It was tough, but it was a fun 2 year. And once the practice started getting on its feet and able to bring in someone else to do the job more professionally than me, I was looking for something else to do. And my dad, who was the president of Cisco Music at that time, and give you a short background, Cisco Music Los Angeles is a subsidiary of Cisco Music International, which is located in Japan. Cisco International has been around since 1968, and they started as retail, and they grew to have multiple retail stores, I think 10 or 12 retail stores, and each store specializes in one genre of music and distribution, and they were doing a lot of house, techno, hip-hop, DJ parties, that type of thing. Cisco Los Angeles, where my dad worked, support Cisco International, and we also did distribution, and at the time we were working with DCC, Compact Classic, Classic Records, and you know, a lot of the I call it the original audiophile label, Mobile Fidelity. Then we started a little audiophile division. And I started working at Cisco in their accounting department and kind of worked my way up, and I went from accounting to CFO to marketing, and it just kind of started learning the business, and I really fell in love with the industry. And it was really my first experience at CES that opened my eyes. I think it was 1994 that really opened my eyes to what this industry is all about.
Did you grow up as someone who listened to a lot of music and also appreciated when something sounded really good? Like you'd compare, oh, this mobile fidelity of this record sounds so amazing next to this one.
No. I have always loved music. Music has always been a big part of my life, but it's more of the, I listen to music because I like the artist. I like the music. It mattered at the moment of my life, whether it was with friends, at a concert, at a game, you know, music tied, weaved into a lot of things I was doing. And it just always made me happy. And it was just a big part. And plus, you know, my dad always had music at home, and we were always listening to classical, to jazz, to Japanese music, to Chinese music. And we had tickets to the Dorothy Chandler in Los Angeles. So we used to go see in Hollywood Bowl. So music was always part of our life in one form or another.
Do you remember the first record you bought with your own money?
Depeche Mode. I used to have these little turntables, those little baby turntables that play the 7-inch. And I used to, I would, you know, help my mom out and make, get an allowance. And I would buy like the Beach Boys, the Go-Go's. That was like the early on. But then when I started working and buying records, I'm a product of 70s, 80s music. And my first concert and record I purchased with my own hard-earned money was Depeche Mode.
Nice. And what was it that kind of blew your mind at that CES show?
How big it was, how everything sounded so amazing. So music sounded different, you know, the size of the hardware, how, you know, each room can sound different with the same music playing, and also all the little gadgets. It was all new to me.
So at what point did you think that you wanted to be involved in the, you know, creating the music product part of it as opposed to the electronics part?
So I was exposed to the reissue world and making records much early on, because Cisco Music was one of the first labels to really introduce the 180 gram record to our industry.
Huh.
In the 80s, when the world was starting to go digital and people were covering CDs, record pressing plant was closing. There weren't as many people pressing records. At the time, King Record licensed a lot of titles from London Decca, and they released a series of classical albums called the Super Analog Disc, and they were pressed on 180 gram records. Not a lot of people at the time really knew how to do that, so my dad invited members from King Record, from JVC, who was really good at pressing 180 gram records in Japan, to the States. And they kind of gather at RTI and Camrio and discuss the process and how to press a really good, quiet 180 gram record, because at that time, most records were 140 gram. So the thickness of the record requires a different way of pressing, a different cooling system. If, you know, if you didn't cool enough, or if you press too hot, you know, it distorts the groove. So I grew up kind of around this information, but it wasn't until probably 1997 when Cisco launched an audiophile label, I asked my dad if, you know, if that's something I could be involved in. And that was my first experience learning about mastering, about pressing, creating jackets, tours at Stout and Printing in City of Industry. And it was a journey that I got on this train and never got off, and I love it.
What was it about creating the physical product there that you loved so much?
There's a certain pride to it, to see the finished work, to see your vision come to life. That's something that you can touch and experience. Also, I've always had a vision when I'm listening to a record. It's not just a musical journey. It's also a visual journey. So the way we've always created our packaging, it's like when you're sitting down listening to the music, I want you to also, you know, have a tactile experience, something to read, learn a little bit about the artist, the way it was recorded. I wanted to be both stimulating visually and musically. And I love working with a team and being able to do that.
Do you remember the first release that you worked on?
Yes. Like I'm thinking, because they all, a lot of these are blurred together. It was June Christie, Something Cool. But then I was heavily involved where I call it when my dad was working with Jennifer Warnes and we were doing Famous Blue Raincoat.
And that was for Cisco.
That was for Cisco.
And then you came back to her for Impex also, I think.
Yes. Jennifer and I have been working together for over 20 years.
Wow.
It's been a great relationship. Yeah. And we reissued her album, The Well, The Hunter, A Famous Blue, and then her most recent new album, Another Time and Another Place.
So for Cisco and then later for Impex, like how do you come up with what you're going to reissue? Do you have like a wish list and then you start talking to the labels that own them? Like how does that, what's that process like?
Oh, it's a lengthy process. We sit down and of course there is a wish list. And that's exactly what it is. It's a wish list. And then we go and we research, and oftentimes a lot of those titles are already being done by our competitors or the labels themselves. So we do a lot of homework on who's doing them, when it was last reissue, how many versions has it been done? Was it reissued both US, Europe, Asia? And once we find a title that's a good fit for us, that we think would sell well, that we know could sound good, and we have resources, meaning that we have access to archives, artwork, then we approach the owners of the album and discuss licensing. And it title by title, it's different. Every label works a little different. Every artist works a little different.
So those early ones you were doing for Cisco, and then later when you started doing them for Impex, did that process change at all? Like, did you sort of the criteria of what you wanted to put out change, or the types of music, or was it really pretty consistent all along that, you know, you're going to have your, like, this is what we think is going to work and that's how you're going to go about it?
Well, the foundation of clearing for a title is the same, but it has changed. I mean, over the years, the labels are requiring larger commitments. Sometimes, you know, we move from manufacturing agreements to licensing agreement, which is different. We used to have access to master tapes. Now, oftentimes, we have access to what they call a copy of the master tape. We would receive a flat one-to-one transfer of the original analog tape, unless you're working with the artists themselves and they have a copy of the tapes themselves.
How does that one-to-one transfer compare to the master tape? Can you tell a difference?
I can't answer that because I'm not hearing the master tape. So all I'm hearing is the transfer. I would hope that if the transfer isn't good, we can tell it's not a good transfer. But if it's a really good transfer, it should be very, very similar to the master tape. It's supposed to be a flat one-to-one, no EQ. If the transfer machine set up correctly, the technician is diligent, it should sound, you know, just as good, almost as good. I mean, there's always a degradation of when one generation to another generation,
right.
But it should be extremely slight that it's not that noticeable.
And the idea is to preserve the actual master tape by not having it out quite so much. So there's more and more of this kind of one-to-one transfer going on.
Yeah. Yeah. And also I think for the liability, I mean, for the safety of the tape, what if it's lost? And right. it changed, you know, early on we had access directly to the master tapes. Then they said, okay, you can have access to the master tape if you live in the West Coast. If the vault's in the West Coast, you're in West Coast. And then for a while, if the vault's on the East Coast and you work with an East Coast engineer, then the engineer can have the master tapes. So our first few titles with Sony, since their tapes are in New York, we used to work with the late George Marino at Sterling because he used to have access to the master tapes. But now as a whole with Sony, it's mostly, you know, safety copies. Universal, we still can have access to the original master tapes. But every project is really different.
Right. Well, and then also, aren't there some where they say you can have access to a high def digital copy of it? Like, is that another option?
That is definitely an option if you want a high resolution master. But Impex is known for vinyl, and I like to stay true to the form. So we always request and work from the analog stores, unless the title itself is a digital recorded title. But I would say most of our catalog is vinyl. We work from either the original or just a flat one-to-one transfer from the original, nothing right. less. And we're also very transparent. We, you know, we note it on our jackets, you know, the sources, if it's, you know, analog tape, you know, analog master, analog board, analog lathe, or is it a tube lathe, a solid state lathe? We have it all written in our jackets.
Right. So if you're ranking the stuff, you'd rather have the master tape and then flat one to one, and then you know, all else is lost. You go with that high res. No matter how high res it is, the fact that it's digital is going to have an effect on how it's going to come out on vinyl, right?
Yes. And there's very, very few titles in our catalog that's from a digital source. Sometimes they may have a digital fingerprint, which is not the same as a digital source. It's like not like we're accepting a digital master.
Right. I think that on your Saturday night in San Francisco with Al DiMeola and John McLaughlin and Paco de Lucia, there's something in there that needed to be fixed because there was some damage to the tape. So there's like some digital tweaking in it, but it's still going analog at the beginning and the end.
Absolutely. So we worked from the original analog tape. We mixed from the original tape and we mastered it from analog tape, and it was cut on tube lathe. What was different was we went back, we baked the tape at Skywalker Studio in Northern California, and we transferred that to a DSD. And then from DSD, it was mixed on an analog board, cut to an analog tape, mastered from the analog, and then cut on an analog tube lathe.
Right. And the reason for doing the DSD is because of the condition of the tape, or
the preservation of the tape. Yeah. Because of the condition of the tape, you know, we knew we had one or two passes at most. So the way to capture the tape at its highest quality was to DSD.
Do you think that people can get too precious about the whole, oh, you used any digital at all? When you're listening to that record, you think, oh, it just sounds great. If you didn't know that, you wouldn't necessarily pick up on it. Is the whole, like, keeping every single thing analog, is that a little overrated?
For me personally, I prefer to keep to its truest form the best I can. But to a certain degree, if for example, the tapes were really in a fragile state and you want to reissue this album and you want to preserve the tape, it is not in your best interest to run that tape over and over again. If you had one pass, capturing on DSD is ideal. Digital has a fingerprint, has its own fingerprint. I rather have a really good sounding album than an album that's completely true to its source, but doesn't sound as good.
Right.
So, but for Impex, we've always worked off of analog tape for most of our LP titles. We try to stay in that domain, but on few occasions, if a digital fingerprint is needed, like Saturday Night, you know, we do what it takes to make the album sound really good.
Right. And you disclose it.
Yeah. And we disclose it. Yeah. Click, Patricia Barber, the album Click, it's recorded in DSD. It's the master is a digital master. It also sounds fantastic.
Chicago's own Patricia Barber.
That's right.
I've sent her notes about this. So yeah, no, and she has a lot of fantastic sounding records. So.
Impex has been very fortunate to be able to reissue some of her wonderful classics. We did Cafe Blue, Nightclub, and Companion all on the one step, and all three of them sound absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, it's like you're in the green mill with her.
Yes. It has that liveliness, that spaciousness. She feels right there with you.
Can't find guitars that scream like you, or a desire that fills me.
Carol Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Now that summer has kicked in, you know what beer really hits the spot? Cold Time, Revolution's premium lager. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, and a touch of German hops and pure Great Lakes water. It's never pasteurized, and the brewed low and slow badge on the can attests to a slower, lower temperature fermentation that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. Cold Time is available in 12 packs of 12-ounce cans. So at some point, 2010 to be precise, you and your father launched Impex after having been at Cisco. What prompted you to go from one to starting your own label?
Cisco closed in 2008, and I took some time off, and I decided I was going to go back to banking and finance world. It's something that's a little more stable. I was looking for a new career venture and also something that provided benefits. Being a single mom, I was looking for something that had like great benefits. But I realized after the first year, this is not for me. I was feeling really antsy. It didn't feel right. And I was talking to friends, and they kept saying, you know, come back to the music world. And I said, I'm not sure if I can find something that's a good fit for me. And just through conversations with good friends and encouragement, I started Impex Records. And I started Impex Record with my original Cisco team. There were two very important players that helped me build Impex, but they were also the same team that, you know, helped me at Cisco, and that was Robert Slager, who is my art director, and Bob Donnelly, who sometimes plays the role as producer, and he's also our QC manager. So together we got together and we said, you know, let's give this a run and see if we can make something of it, and this time we'll do it our way.
So what was the first thing that you did differently?
We released the album when we felt it was ready. We weren't under the same time pressure of you need to put out so many titles within this window. And we took our time and we test checked the stampers. And if we weren't happy, we would cut it, make a new stamper.
What were the first albums that you guys released?
The first one was Dave Rubeck, Time Further Out. Followed by Jennifer Warren's The Well box set. And then Willie Nelson, Redheaded Stranger.
Oh, nice. Do you remember the first reviews you read?
I think the first review was Audiophile Publication. I think it was The Absolute Sound. And then it was Audio Beat. And they were all really positive, which really gave the team encouragement. You know, it's like, you know, we did it. It's good. You know, people are happy with the choices that we made. And with The Well, we did something really quite spectacular, because Texas is an important part of Jennifer's life, and it brings her a lot of meaning for her. So when she recorded The Well, and I looked at the artwork for The Well, we wanted something that had that, I call it the woodsy feeling. And so we released it on 45 with a gorgeous booklet. And we made, instead of the cardboard boxes we normally use, I had beautiful wood boxes made for this release.
When you come into this world, you know, you're entering this market of these high-end audiophile releases. Are the other companies that are in there already, like Mobile Fidelity or Analog Productions or whoever, are they welcoming? Do you get sort of like a, hey, that really great job on that Jennifer Warren's record and the Willie Nelson? Or is there kind of like a, ooh, all right, look out, you know, we got more competition and it's, you know, it's more of a competitive situation.
I like to think it's friendly competition. You know, obviously we're all competing in the same circle and for the same titles, but there are many times where I've had team members and or staff members from Mobile Fidelity, from Premonition, from Acoustic Sounds, where they're saying, you know what, great album, we really love it, I think I'm going to purchase one. And as much as we all make records, we also are consumers and we buy each other's records. So there's a lot of pat in the back and, you know, encouragement to each other.
And I mean, like a lot of these mastering engineers have worked with, you know, you. Like, I mean, I was with Kevin Gray when I met you, and I know he's worked with you, and, you know, Chris Bellman or Ryan K. Smith or Bernie Grundman. I mean, a lot of these are the names that you hear, and I'm sure that there are other ones as well. Can you tell an Impex record from, you know, an Analog Productions record or one of these others?
Well, when you work with, you know, Kevin Gray and Chris Bellman and Bernie Grundman and Ryan Smith and the late George Marino and all, Bob Ludwig, you're already reaching the excellence. These are top-notch, you know, experienced engineers. But for Impex, I believe we have our own signature sound. You know, and because I've been working with the same team for over two decades, you know, we all know what we're looking for. We're very proactive. Bob Donnelly's in the studio, in the mastering studio, and we're listening. We're comparing it to previous versions, to the original versions, and we're trying to bring the original and make it even better.
You have this one step of Getz, Gilberto, and mm-hmm. It's a beautiful package. I mean,
thank you.
Booklet, and it's, you know, two albums at 45 RPM, and it's the special vinyl you have, this kind of this smoky, transparent or translucent vinyl. You know, there have been other, you know, versions of that as well. Analog Productions has put out the 2x45 RPM and 33 mm-hmm. RPM. So what is the impetus when you sort of look at all this other stuff to think, all right, we're going to do this one even better? Like, how did that happen?
Yeah. Well, I was approached by the Getz family on reissuing this album, and we were discussing it for the 60th anniversary. At the beginning, I thought, you know, I'm not sure that it might be a financial suicide because it's been reissued 400 times. And truth be told, Analog Production has did a great job with the 45. I own it and enjoy it. But when we start thinking about if we're going to do it, it's going to have to be the definitive version and it's going to have to be better. And we started mapping out what is better to us and looking not just from the label's standpoint, but from a consumer standpoint, what is better for the consumer? What can we add to the value to this? And part of this was working with the Getz estate, the historical liner notes, the photographs, but a great achievement that I'm really proud of about this album is that I think it sounds phenomenal. We have done a phenomenal job taking this album to the next level. We use the same Analog master tape as Analog Production. It's just mastered differently. Plus, we did it on a one-step process using the VR900 vinyl formulation. That's why the vinyl has a little bit of transparency to it. I think there are other, I call it the VR900 because that's the official purchase order name. Mm. I know there are other labels have a different name for it, maybe Super Vinyl or something like that. It's being used by Mobile Fidelity and Kraft.
Yeah, I know Mobile Fidelity calls it Super Vinyl.
Okay.
Yeah, so so what is the quality do you think that your one step of this album brings out that none of the other ones have brought out?
I think it's even more transparent. I feel like I'm being serenaded by the voices. It's just a little more musical. It's a little more three-dimension. I just feel like it's beautiful. It serenades. And the separation of each instrument is very apparent.
It's funny because I have my dad's old records, and he had I don't know if it's an original copy of it. Like, I don't know if it's first pressing, but it has the sticker on it. It says, contains the hit single, The Girl from Ipanema. And so I gave that a wash, and I put that on, and then I put on Your One Step, and it was a big difference. You know, the original was fine, aside from, you know, it being crackling, having been in my dad's collection for whatever. But yeah, the sort of the that dimensionality, if that's the word, just the sense of things being spread all over, you know, the sound stage, things being spread all over the room, feeling like you're hearing sort of the scraping of the strings of the guitar, yeah. Sort of the warmth in the voice, kind of like in your ear. I mean, I'm not trying to do an ad for this or anything, but it really was one of these things where, like, sometimes you'll do these A/B things, especially with an original. Sometimes, you know, an original of something will still sound like sort of pop because it's like made from the master before the master's been, you know, sitting around for decades. But this sounded way better than the original that I have, at least. So
thank you. Well, that's the goal. And we, you know, we had a couple of versions to listen to. And, you know, this is a good album. Gets-Gilberto is a good album. It was a good tape. So, but to take it to the next level, we really thought about what was important. And for every Impex title, what we always want to achieve is a musical feel. We want to have separation, a good sound stage. And we want to feel like you're part of the music. Like, you know, it's alive.
Do you get a lot of that where, like, someone who owns, you know, holds the rights to a record or is the family member comes to you and says, we would like you to do the definitive version of this record? Because that's pretty affirming.
It is, and always feels good. I do, not a lot, you know, from time to time, I have artists who come and say, hey, look, you know, or the estates will say, we're doing a special anniversary edition. We'd love for you to be involved. And it feels, you know, it feels great to be asked. It's always an honor, but we can't always, you know, take on every project because I have to look at, is this album still in demand? Is the sales going to meet the sales numbers? Will meet the process of creating this album, or is this an album even good for the market, for our audience?
Well, and you alluded earlier to the, you know, like the labels sort of saying they need you to commit to more records than maybe you did early on. Yes. Like, how is that? What's that progression been like? Like, at first, when you were doing this, say 10 years earlier, like how many copies of something would you be expected to press up? And is it just kind of a guessing game on like what the market's going to be? Do you have like sort of an option that if the first 1,000 sell out, you could do another 2,000 or whatever? Like, how does it work?
And previously the agreements are usually a 3-year term. You can always renew it. You know, there was a minimum that you had to go in with, and we always, of course, commit to the minimum. And if we can press more, that's always the goal, but at least we meet the minimum. Now the minimum has continuously increased. And if you don't go in with, you know, starting number like 5,000, sometimes, you know, it's hard to get even a nod your direction.
It's part of the negotiation too, like, oh, we're going to do this as a numbered edition or a not numbered edition or a limited edition, or like, how does that all factor into it?
That's kind of, it's up to the label how we want to market it and make it limited or not limited. From Sony's perspective or Warner or Universal, it's more like, how many are you planning to commit, period? What's the retail?
Is the numbering a good marketing hook for you guys? Like we're only doing 2,000 of these and you're gonna get number, you know, 306, you know, and that makes it more attractive somehow.
It does make it more attractive. It makes it more collectible. But it's also by some, you know, titles. Certain are Gets-Gilberto, you know, 60th anniversary. If you create something really unique and beautiful and you make it limited, it is more attractive, and it's also has more of a value to it. But if you don't make it limited edition, it just means you can continuously reprint, and there's no sense of importance to buy the album.
Right. And you've had some, like, for instance, Earth, Wind, and Fire's That's the Way of the World, which came out originally in 2013. And I think you repressed it last year.
Yes.
And in 2013, Speaker's Corner, which is based in Germany, did their own version of it as well. When you go into that knowing you're going to put that on in 2013, are you aware that this other, I mean, granted, European-based audiophile label is doing it at the same time? Is that part of the discussion?
Oftentimes, I'm not aware if they're going to be reissuing in another country, because my clearance is usually for U.S., Canada, sometimes Asia. But if I know they're doing it in say, Germany in 2023, and I want to put it out in 2025, I would still consider, because it's a different market, also probably different master sources. And some of the titles like Earth, Wind, and Fire, it would be hard for me to think that they would have access to the master tape.
Right.
Knowing that Sony does not let that leave the States.
And was that an instance where you had a working relationship with Sony, and like, how did you identify that as an album that you wanted to do?
It was part of our discussion. You know, when we look for titles that we want to reissue, part of the criteria is that it has to be something we like. One of us have to love it, listen to it, own it. And then we discuss, well, why do we want to reissue? Is it because it hasn't been reissued? Is there any historical importance? What makes it an attractive title? And that's one of the titles unanimously all of us love.
And I assume it did well, because you went and did a repress of it recently.
It did. It was serial numbered. It sold out, and we had quite a few requests. So we went back to Sony and extended our agreement, and we pressed more non-number versions.
Right, and that's the way it's supposed to work, right? You sell out, and then you go back to the label, and they're happy to sell more copies of it, and there's no conflict there.
No, there's no conflict. What I'm trying to do more these days is have no serial number for the 33 version. So we're going to press, as long as we have the agreement, as long as it sells well, we're going to make the 33 available. And the 45s and the one steps will be limited edition.
Have you had some where you've said, oh, we want to press up more of these, and they said no?
Yes, when the licensing expires and the label or the artist is not interested in renewing.
Is that because they have someone else who's lined up to do another version of it again?
Could be, or just for whatever reason, they're just not interested. They don't want to dilute the market. They don't want too much product out there.
Right.
I mean, we sold out Patricia Barber at Cafe Blue, and people have asked me, you know, where can I get more copy? Are you going to repress? When it's a one step, we are very firm on our numbers. Even if we get more requests, more orders, more commitments, if we sell through what we press, that is it. We owe that to the consumers and who have purchased the limited edition copies.
Right. Because they say, oh, there's only going to be this many, and then they're double that many, then they're like, oh, it's not as collectible. And everyone's looking on Discogs to see what the median price of everything is at this point.
On that one step, when we say it's limited edition to whatever the number is, we are firm on that.
Right. How often do you go for, you know, do you say, we want to do a version of this album, and you find out, oh, you know, these other companies are all trying to do that one too. And is there sort of a competition? Is there sort of like a little, you know, show that you have to do to show that, you know, please pick me, like sort of The Bachelor, but it's albums?
Definitely there is. Oftentimes when there's titles we're interested, we're in the same pool fighting for the same titles. And I'm always looking, and just last week, you know, I was going through some titles. I'm like, shoot, it's already on MoFi's list. Shoot, it's part of the Atlantic 75. And when it's already cleared by another label, there's nothing more you can do. If it's potentially in the running, I think it comes down to the units we can commit, or what else are we going to do? You know, how many more other titles, or maybe we're going to secure more titles from this artist.
Is there
a numbers game?
Is there like a album that's been like at the top of your list that you've just really wanted to do for a long time, and you're just waiting for the chance?
It's off my list, but for years I've always wanted to do Steely Dan. because I had a chance to do it back in 2007. And I felt like we only did one title and then Cisco closed the door in 2008. So I never had a chance to finish the catalog, and I wanted to release it again. But, you know, Chad did the whole series, and I'm happy for him. It's, you know, great albums, great titles.
When that series went to Analog Productions, did you put in a bid for it? Like, do people bid for that, or was it just like, oh, they're just going with them?
I think the labels are pretty, they keep things confidential. You know, they don't want it. They're not, their goal isn't to create a fight, but they do let us know that other people are bidding. So just go ahead and put your bid in. And I can't focus on what Analog Production might do, or what Mobile Fidelity or, you know, any other label. I just kind of focus on what Impex can do, the numbers that we can commit, our ideas, and hope for the best.
So you did put in a bid for the Steely Dan, but they just went with those
guys. I did. Yes.
Interesting. What were the ones that you were most excited that you did get?
I would say Saturday Night in San Francisco. Really, really excited. You know, we did Friday Night on 33. We did Friday Night on 45. And it was really the success of Friday Night 45, Impex version, that really kind of put us on the map. And doing Saturday Night was such a great experience. It was such a journey. And it was also being able to collaborate with artists to a depth of a level that I normally don't do. And I got to work with both Al Dignola and John McLaughlin. And because of this journey, we end up making a little short documentary. It's called Discovering Saturday Night in San Francisco. It's on the Elusive Disc YouTube channel. Mm. And it's a 25-minute documentary to show the journey of where we started to the completion. And we took the camera with us to the pressing plant, to Stoughton Printing, you know, every step of the way. We filmed it.
And Elusive Disc, you've been working with them since 2017. They're in Indiana. So how did that change things for you? Like, you had the first 7 years where you're on your own, then you're working with Elusive Disc. Like, what did that enable you to do?
It's been a wonderful experience and journey. So Elusive Disc used to be a distributor of mine and of Cisco Music. We have known them for almost three decades, and they're good people, and they've been a good distributor. So when I was looking for a partner, because I was at a point where Impex grew, where I was just too much on my own. I mean, I was really doing everything from licensing to all the artwork, the mastering, and then the packing, the order, the sales, the shipping, you know, everything. And Elusive, you know, I talked to Elusive, and they didn't have a label under their belt, and they were very interested, and they were also a big supporter and a fan of Impex. And our visions were very similar. That's what made it really important. The way we view business, the way we view customers, they're very customer friendly, and they're a family run business, been in business 33 years, and the way they handle issues, the way they promote the records, how they expect the records to be done. It's very aligned with Impex. So we joined forces. I am still running Impex, and I handle all the licensing, production, manufacturing, marketing. And once the product is finished, it's handed over to Elusive, and they deal with all the sales, the shipping, more marketing.
Right.
So they alleviate a lot of stress off of me. They do a really good job taking care of the customers. So I rarely hear any complaints. Oftentimes people tell me, you know, how good they are. When there's a problem, they're very responsive. We're just very aligned in our views of running business.
Did the number of albums you put out a year change after that relationship started?
Definitely. I think when I was doing it on my own, it was like four titles a year, and that was maximum. Now it's six, eight. This year we're putting out 11 titles.
And what's the kind of breakdown of those with like one steps versus regular 33 RPM versus gold discs and SA CDs?
We don't do many CDs. And when we do, it's a partner of the LP. Most of my LPs are 33 and 45s. The one steps are put out or are chosen to be one steps when the titles have some, there's some kind of historical relevance, an anniversary edition or something really special that we can add to it. I try to be mindful of the price point. I do know it's a little more expensive. So if I'm going to do a one step, I want to make sure the consumer has something, a lot of extra goodies. It's both a musical and visual journey. June 14th, we're going to be shipping our number six one step, and that's Sing and Dance with Frank Sinatra.
That's where I was going next.
I am really, really excited. Probably to date, that is the most beautiful packaging that we have created. We worked with Chuck Granata, who is a Sinatra historian, who did the liner notes. He's also the producer on this project, along with Andreas Myers from Swan Studio in New York City. So we have the original 10-inch, we have bonus material, and we have live sessions where you really see Frank in action with the musicians, just the stories that we have, the photos. It's so beautiful that I was telling the team, and when I'm done with this, I want it to be a coffee table book. I want people to leave it out. I don't want it to be in a shelf.
You did a demonstration of that at the Expona convention. Of course, it's on this fantastic equipment in this beautiful room, and it sounded great. And it's an earlier Sinatra than I'm used to hearing as well. And you guys played a little bit afterwards of the session where he's sort of, you know, leading the session, and you hear him kind of giving directions and interacting, and it's like you're in the room with him. And that was really fun to listen to.
It was a unique experience for the audience, and that was also something we wanted to share. We wanted to share different sides of Sinatra. You know, most people don't realize, you know, he's a good producer. He's a good director. You know, he has a great vision. And this album was really important on so many levels because, as I shared in the demonstration, you know, Sinatra's career wasn't doing well. Columbia was seriously thinking about dropping him. It was this album that changed the direction of his career. You know, he was no longer just that romantic, you know, ballad singer, but he, you know, this was jazzy, it was poppy. It also showed Sinatra being in control. You know, and also we went from a 70 shellac to a 33, a higher fidelity. That was also new back in that time.
Right. Well, and also this is a title that, you know, as you say, has historical significance, but it's also not a title that people know over and over and over and over, like there are a lot of other ones. Was there kind of a sweet spot there where you're like, here's something that we think is great and also something that everyone doesn't know backwards and forwards?
Yes. So putting it on a one step at the price point of $125, we wanted to put out an album that had historical significance, that wasn't repressed or isn't out there in multiple versions. And we wanted to give you an incredible visual journey. I think 32 pages of historical insight and just gorgeous photos, photos that most people will not see, like telegrams between Sinatra and Western Union, the labels, you know, photos of the original master tapes. We're so proud of it.
So, and that's one where you'd done was it a 33 RPM earlier?
Yes. We released it on its 70th anniversary on a 33. It pretty much sold out within 2 years. And we had a lot of extra materials. We had all the bonus, the session, and more artwork and more story to tell. And we said, you know what? This deserved to be on a one step. It really needs to be shared.
Do you have a lot of discussions on, you know, should this be a one step or just regular 33 RPM or 245 RPMs, but not one step? Like, how do those conversations go and what sort of fits into which category?
Most of our team discussion is, should this be a 33 or 45? With the one step, there's not a whole lot of discussion. It's known. It's like, all right, you look at the title and you know this should be a one step. But oftentimes our discussion, if it's 33, 45, obviously with the 45, you have the higher fidelity. It also gives us more real estate to create incredible booklets and add photos or work with the estate or the artist directly to curate a story that the artist wants to share. But I'm also mindful of the price point. You know, a lot of people are just happy with the 33, won't be able to offer all of that.
Right. And for the one step is part of it also, this is an amazing sounding record. And therefore it makes sense to be a one step because it's the kind of thing that, you know, there are plenty of records out there that are engineered and produced in a way where you could do them on a one step, but they're never going to sound that much better. Whereas, you know, it seems like you're choosing ones that are going to sound that much better. And so is that like what's the calculus there and what makes something sound so good that you think it's going to be worth it for the one step aside from all of the bonus materials?
We try to make all our records sound good, right. But when we're choosing one step, you know, we're also thinking how much better can we make this album sound? So we start off with an album that we know already sound good. So the goal is take it to the next level, the definitive version. We think about the mastering process, how we're going to EQ it, which engineer we're going to work with. And also with the vinyl formulation, the VR900 really benefit because that's not a formula is a one size fit all. It's very transparent and it really brings a lot of information out, but not all information is good information. But yeah, when we're doing the one step, we look at, besides all the visual bonus, it already starts off with a really good sounding album.
Right. So Mobile Fidelity has their one steps. Analog Productions has their one steps. Kraft has started their one steps. I'm sure that there are other ones as well. Does that make it harder to sort of sell these or does it help because everyone knows what a one step is? And so they realize, yeah, this is going to be worth $125 because that's the kind of leap, even though obviously you guys are doing your own version of a one step. You're not just doing a Mobile Fidelity one step.
I think it helps. I think it helps. It expands the market. It brings more awareness, whether I'm doing it, MoFi's doing it, Analog, you know, it helps educate the audience what the one step is. And also it sets the standard so the consumer knows, you know, if I'm going to pay for one step, this is what I'm going to get. This is what I expect to get.
And moving forward, is jazz still going to be like a big focus? Does rock and soul, do those come into it more or less? Or this kind of old, you know, old pop, like, I don't know what else you'd call, you know, Sinatra from like 49. But what's sort of the sweet spot of, you know, having these different genres and eras that you're repressing?
So jazz is always a really popular genre in the audiophile world. But so is rock and female vocal. I like to expand our catalog is just having the opportunity. And I'm knocking on doors and saying, hey, look, you know, we have done all these titles. It's been really well reviewed. Impex has gotten so many great reviews, so many industry support. We have data to back up what we can do. So it's just being able to give them the opportunity. But I like to see us expand more into the rock, into more female vocals,
right?
Maybe a few more classical. Classicals are a little tougher to sell because it's a smaller market.
Yeah, I learned that with my dad's record collection. It's interesting because some of that stuff sounds fantastic, but it's not as in demand.
No.
And like the Earth, Wind, and Fire sounds great. And you know, getting more of that kind of era, you know, and with that kind of care is pretty cool as well.
If you love classical, our most recent new release, Heifetz the Lark, it's probably one of the best sounding classicals I have ever heard. And I've had listened to a lot of classical. It is emotional. It's dynamic. It's engaging. When I when I listen to that, I literally feel goosebumps. It's so powerful. You can feel it in your chest, in your ribs. It's an amazing album.
What are the top three Impex sellers?
Top three. Friday Night. Well, that's hard because a lot of them did really well. I mean, Friday Night in San Francisco, Saturday Night in San Francisco, Thelonious Monk, Monk's Dream, Jennifer Warren's Famous Blue Raincoat, Jennifer Warren's The Hunter. I don't have any top three.
No, that's fine. I would have asked for top five, but I didn't want to be greedy.
Earth, Wind, and Fire, Miles Davis, ESP. I mean, these are really good selling titles.
And what's the kind of biggest challenge, you know, looking forward to in the next like year or two?
The biggest challenge is getting more titles that I want. And also trying to do, I'm very pleased with how Impex has presented the One Step. And now I'm thinking, how do I take that to the next level?
What is the next level?
We're still working on the secret sauce.
Nice. is that more of a presentation thing than an audio thing at this point?
It's both. For Impex, the audio, I like to say it's pretty consistent. So when you're shopping for Impex, you're just looking at the title saying, hey, Do I like this title? Do I want this title in my collection? Have I heard Impex version? Because the team I work with, we've been working together for 20 something years. I've worked with my art director for 24, and I think Bob Donnelly 16 years. There's such a good synergy. And I do believe that every label has its own signature. So our records has the Impex signature sound, but now it's not just the consistency of quality, ticks and pops and dynamics, but now I'm thinking, what more can I do to bring more life into that, into the record?
What would be the biggest difference between an Impex record that comes out like now versus one that was coming out in the first few years you guys were around?
I feel like now our sound is more musical. Our pressings are dead silent. And, there's a little more consistency now.
Nice.
We work really hard on our QC department. Now, there's so many hands that are involved in making records. And even though you can have a approved, a flawless damper, doesn't guarantee the finished album will be flawless. But we take every measure and every step to make sure the end product is excellent in quality.
Like, what are the most important elements, would you say? Is it the mastering versus the pressing, all of the above? It all has to click?
All the above has to click. It starts from the beginning. The beginning is you have to have a good source, the master tapes. If the master tape is not really good, it's like you don't have a good canvas to work with. And working with an engineer that is aligned with your vision, that is open to discussion, and open to critique. Not all engineers are open to conversation. So having a great engineer that you work with, then from there, getting a good test pressing. We check every stamper that's going to go to press. And if there's a problem with the press test pressing, we go back to RTI and say, hey, look, you know, we're finding these problems. Is there a problem on the mother? Do we need to cut a new lacquer? Do we need to make a new stamper? From there, if we approved a good stamper, then it goes to press. And sometimes in the middle of the press, RTI technicians will pull a copy here and there, and Bryce, the QC manager at RTI, will take a listen to make sure that, you know, we're still on track. So every step is important. There's not one that's more important than the other. But if I had to pick one, if I was cornered and said one, I would say the source. Because it's like building a house. You can't build a great house when the foundation is all graveled and, you know, loose rock. So you need to have a good source.
Right. So what for you is the most exciting part of the process?
I love the art part. I love sitting with Robert Slager, discussing how we want to present the album. What's the visual journey? You know, what goodies can we find for our viewers? You know, what historical insight or photos? Duke, for example, Duke Ellington Indigo, with the 65th anniversary edition, which is shipping next week. We didn't have much assets to work with from Sony. And Chuck Granata found out the photographer, one of the photographers for Duke Ellington, you know, when he passed, he had no heir. So he willed all his photos to Yale University. So we went to Yale digging for some great photos to be aligned with the album. And it's those type of journey that's really interesting. But also on the musical side, I can create amazing packaging. But the record doesn't sound good. It doesn't sound good. So having a really good sounding album is probably more important than the visual journey. So when we get a really good tape, it's always a very exciting feeling for me. It's like, all right, I got something to work with. And when we hear the test pressing and I'm sitting there listening and I get that goosebump feeling, that feeling like, okay, you're there. You're there.
Nice.
It's always a really good feeling. Then there's a big sense of relief. Then the rest is like, okay, it's up to the pressing plant to bring that home. When I'm listening to the test pressing and I don't feel it, that's where I start to get worried.
And then you go back?
Then I have to decide, and I call Bob Donnelly. Is it the source? Is there more we can do? Why is it not captured? Is it the vinyl? Because sometimes vinyl formulations can also change the sound a little bit. We did a 30th anniversary edition of the Jennifer Warren's The Hunter in green vinyl. It was supposed to be 3,000 units pressed only for the 30th anniversary. We did a little something special. We chose a green vinyl formulation visually for visual appearance. It sounds phenomenal. That vinyl formulation and that music, something worked and it sounds great. Really, really good.
So that's when it all clicks and you put on the test press and you're like, okay, we did our job today. This is a good day at the office.
Yeah. Yep. Duke Ellington Indigo, the 65th anniversary edition, is coming out with a very limited 1,000 units in purple vinyl. When we got the test pressing in the purple, we listened to it and we were like, something doesn't sound right. It sounds truncated. It sounds thin. It sounds like I'm listening to a CD. Something is wrong. We changed the color of the vinyl and the formulation, and the music was back. It is exactly what I was hearing on the tape.
Interesting. Yeah, colored vinyl seems like it's sort of, sometimes it sounds fantastic. And I'm like, it's just like a weird splatter pattern, but it sounds just fine. And then sometimes you're like, no, it's a little crackly and a little thin. So the fact that you're finding those good formulations is a good sign.
Color vinyls are hard to quality control because you often can't see the floss. It's like when you wear black, you can see all the lint on you. That's how I kind of see when I do quality control. You can see some of visually see some of the problems, or if there is a problem, you can at least loop it and put it under a microscope. When it's color and it's really pretty with all the splatters and it's really cool looking, but you can't see anything on it. So it's hard to QC.
Yeah. Sometimes I'll have like a red transparent, and I'm just trying to like find the track, and I'm like, wait, where's the track? Cause I can't tell if I'm looking at the track on the one side or the other side. And so you're just kind of like dropping the needle in random places. Anyway, AB, thank you so much. This is really great. I'm really glad we got to talk. This is fascinating. And I look forward to hearing and seeing and enjoying and experiencing many more Impex records to come.
Thank you so much for having me on your show. It was really fun and it was an honor, and I can't wait to share more titles with you.
That's it for episode 137 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to AB Fahn for sharing her passion and insights into how Impex Records obtains, prepares, and releases its impressive catalog. Impex recently issued a 2LP 45 RPM one-step edition of Stan Getz and João Gilberto's Brazilian jazz classic, Getz Gilberto. Coming June 7th is a one-step of Patricia Barber's Companion, and a one-step of the 1950 album Sing and Dance with Frank Sinatra comes out June 14th. To learn more about the label and to buy its releases, go to ImpexRecords.com. Impex is distributed by the Indiana-based company Elusive Disc. You could order directly from that website too, ElusiveDisc.com. Curopop is produced by Chris Wake, who takes these episodes one step beyond. For a mere $24, you could become a Curopop friend and help keep this thing going. Please contribute at Curopop.com. Your support is much appreciated. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Curopop on Twitter, X, and Instagram at CaroPopcast. You follow me as well at Mark Caro, at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Caro Pop conversation. Thanks.